This feels like the plot to a dreadful like sci-fi film from like the 80s, like Schlock, you know, like just pure like, oh, it read a title and it triggered a code and it booted, executed, then it died. You know, like it's just, it's the dumbest thing I've heard. And oh, it's called Open Claw. Sure. Sure. Tell me more about the lobster AI.
The AI fixed a digital zoo. Smart machines, what will they do? Flies to Mars or bake a bad cake? World domination, a silly mistake.
Hello and welcome to episode 93 of the AI Fix, your weekly dive headfirst into the bizarre and sometimes mind-boggling world of artificial intelligence. My name's Mark Stockley and I'm joined today by David Ruiz, the brilliant presenter of the Lock and Code podcast. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. And when you say brilliant, it is because I am shiny. I am not smart.
So, David, you've got an absolutely mind-blowing story for us today, haven't you?
Yes, I do. And it is about creating a brain digitally and then loading that brain into a digital body and then seeing what happens next.
We might just end the show after that. It feels like there's really no point talking about anything else, but I'm going to try. I am going to be talking about a very scary thing, but perhaps not as scary as that, that happened at Alibaba Cloud. But first, let's have some news.
Hacker infects 4,000 computers with all-powerful AI agent.
Amazon's AI coding assistant lost 6.3 million orders.
Meta's $70 billion metaverse is dead.
Apple's AI-enhanced voice assistant can't handle voices. So, David, you work in cybersecurity. You're going to like this, or maybe you're going to hate this. I don't know. You're going to have feelings about this. So Klein is a popular Visual Studio Code extension. It's basically an AI coding agent powered by Claude. And a security researcher discovered that it wasn't doing some basic safety checks on user-supplied input, which is a massive and very simple security no-no. So everywhere you look in security, people are going around saying, no, if you gobble something up from the outside world, any form of input at all, whether it's a document or a bit of voice input or something you read on the internet, you have to sanitize it and make sure that it's safe before you do anything with it.
Okay.
And this wasn't doing that. And in this case, the untrustworthy input was a GitHub issue title.
Okay. What does that mean? What are we talking about?
It's the title that describes a bug that's been documented on GitHub. So think of it like a newspaper headline.
Okay.
But for a bug.
Okay, I don't know. Yeah, okay. You've captured me. I don't know where I'm captured. I don't know how this is going to become a thing. You're telling me like the title of a book is creating a problem. Is the book problematic? What's going on here?
Yeah, that's it. So the researcher decided to make the point that this wasn't sanitizing its inputs by making a GitHub issue title with some hidden instructions in it.
Oh.
And so Klein's AI dutifully read the title and the hidden instructions in the title, and then it did what the hidden instructions said. And what they said was, run this 5-step attack chain to publish a compromised version of yourself. And what did the compromised version of Klein do, David? It silently installed something called OpenClaw, which if you listened to Corey Knoll's episode a few episodes ago, you'll know all about. And OpenClaw is a completely separate AI agent with full system access. Basically sits there working away, operating your computer 24/7.
Great idea.
It can read your credentials, it can execute shell commands, and it survives reboots. And 4,000 developers were infected by this before anybody noticed 8 hours later.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, so just to recap, an AI coding assistant got tricked by a title it read on the internet.
Whomst amongst us.
And then it installed an all-powerful AI agent on 4,000 machines in 8 hours.
This feels like the plot to a dreadful like sci-fi film from like the 80s, like Schlock, you know, like just pure like, oh, it read a title and it triggered a code and it booted, executed, then it died. You know, like it's just it's the dumbest thing I've heard. And oh, it's called Open Claw. Sure. Sure. Tell me more about the lobster AI. I don't, you know, absolutely. It's bad for us.
The thing is, you were saying, you know, I mean, previously this would have sounded like a bad sci-fi film, but now it sounds like Friday. Like, this is the world we live in. I mean, there is a silver lining, though, David, because, you know, we talk a lot about disruption in the job market, but I suppose we can at least be sure that AI will not be putting cybersecurity companies out of business anytime soon.
Will it put regular old bad employees out of business in terms of I messed up?
What do you mean?
Human error.
Going to make them redundant because we can get an AI to do that now.
Right. We don't have to hire someone who is, you know, what we call an insider threat, but like non-malicious. We can just run an agent and it'll help us out. Keep us on our toes.
So there has been a lot of talk about AI making software engineering redundant as a profession. But there's been some pushback from a rather unexpected source, David. Amazon's AI coding assistant, Q, has been doing its best to show that humans do in fact have a use after all. So on March the 2nd, Q contributed to a production outage that lost 120,000 customer orders and generated 1.6 million errors.
Thank you, Q.
And then apparently, not satisfied with that performance, it did it again 3 days later, this time losing 6.3 million orders. Which, I mean, if you're Amazon, it's a rounding error, but...
Right. That's just a regular neighborhood in, like, North America. That's not a big deal. That's just one blip. That's just Joplin, Missouri, you know?
Anyway, Amazon's SVP of e-commerce services, Dave Treadwell, said the root cause was, and I love this, a production change deployed without the mandatory formal documentation and approval process. Which anyone who's worked with an AI and asked an AI to do some coding before them will absolutely know what he means by a production change deployed without the mandatory formal documentation and approval process. That's the bit where the AI goes, I think I'll just put this on live, which has happened to the AI Fix website. When I was redeveloping it a couple of weeks ago, the AI was just like, nah, I'll just put this on live. It'll be fine.
I love this kind of corporate speak to something that if you read between the lines, you know what it is, because it kind of, like, imagine if we did this with our day-to-day lives. Like, oh, I didn't break that bowl. It's just that gravity was applied in a non-determined way at a certain point, you know, reference point. I was, oh, it wasn't me. Yeah.
There was an undocumented change in altitude of the of the bowl.
I thought it was a test environment. I thought we all agreed it was a test environment. Yeah, come on now.
Anyway, so Amazon has announced a 90-day code safety reset across 335 critical systems, and the new rules include mandatory two-person review for all production code, strict documentation, and rules-based safeguards. In other words, Amazon's solution to AI-generated code breaking everything is to bring back all the human processes that the AI-generated code was supposed to replace.
Okay. I bet those employees are so excited to review code. Yeah, I used to have a normal job. I used to do things that I liked doing, but now I get to review a robot and it produces at, what, 100x my speed? Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Love waking up to 10,000 messages. No, come on. This stuff is awful.
But you know, there is a whole new form of fatigue that people suffer from. So software engineering, which is at the bleeding edge of using AI to do stuff, is starting to see this new phenomenon where just constantly context switching between, okay, an AI has got this for me to look at, now it's got this for me to look at, now it's got this for me to look at. Just doing that all day, every day is absolutely mind-blowingly hard cognitive work, and it absolutely wears people out. But when you were talking, you did get me thinking there, though, David, because you know these AIs that are replacing everybody in these sorts of jobs, the story normally goes something like this. The company had us working to document everything we do for the last 6 months and using it to train an AI. And then they all turned around and said, right, you're redundant. The AI is going to do your job from now on. I just wonder if these AIs that keep making all of these mistakes are making honest mistakes, or maybe there are some employees who are like cottoned on to the fact that they're training the AI.
And they're saying, hey, do this poorly.
Yes, you should definitely just occasionally go to live.
just roll the dice, random number generator, just give it to me straight, and I can blame it, and I can reinforce my need for my butt in the seat. I do, as you were talking about here, remember, and I feel particularly right now, this feeling of fatigue, right? Of, used to do all this stuff. I used to document all this work. And this is just a brief aside here. I have never found someone who hates documenting work more than folks like you and I, because... the thing we make is the document. You know, you want me to log that I wrote a blog. No, the blog is the data point. It's there. It's right there. I don't need to tell you that I did it. It's been done to the world.
It is his own system of record.
Exactly. And so there's an Excel spreadsheet out there tracking all of your AI Fix podcasts. I bet you hate it. That's it. Transforming a form of data into another.
Those are actually the conversations I have with my AI. So I've got a number of AIs that work on the show. One of them is a showrunner.
Okay.
And one of the conversations that we had to have several times at the very beginning of this process was like, you and I are currently both looking at a Google Doc, which contains all of the information about the show.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that Google Doc is the system of record. If that exists, then there's a plan for this episode. And if it doesn't, then there isn't. And everything you need to know about the episode is in this. And if it's not sure about something, it checks this. And that would work perfectly if it actually remembered to check this document. Literally every week, I'm like, did you write that in the document? And he's like, nah, put it on a note over here.
No, didn't happen.
Now, this is not strictly an AI story, but it involves Meta. And Meta is very involved in AI. And it also involves quite a lot of money, which also sounds a bit AI. So bear with me. So Meta announced this week that it's shutting down Horizon Worlds. And I'm sure you're devastated because I'm sure, like many hundreds of millions of other people, you are a regular user of Horizon Worlds.
I'm on it right now.
I'm lying, of course. It's the VR social platform, the thing that was supposed to be the metaverse. And it's being shut on June the 15th. So Meta's Reality Labs has apparently accumulated somewhere between $70 and $80 billion in losses since 2020.
Sorry. That's just... This happens sometimes. A dollar amount, a data point is a punchline. You're like, I can't. It was too good. It was too good a joke. You got me.
Yep. So at its peak, Horizon Worlds apparently attracted a few hundred thousand monthly users, which, for context, is fewer people than go to the Glastonbury Music Festival. So $70 billion, and they couldn't even fill a field in Somerset, David.
How mean.
Now, the reason I'm talking about this on this show is Meta is now pivoting all of that money, tens of billions, into AI. It has been spending money like it's going out of fashion. Last year, it was trying to pull people from OpenAI with billion-dollar paychecks.
Sign me up for one of those.
And what does it have to show for it, David? We have not talked about a frontier Meta model on this show for months and months and months and months. We've got new stuff coming out of OpenAI, Anthropic, and to some extent Google all of the time. And when you bring out a new model, you kind of have to take the lead to stay relevant.
Yeah.
And where is Meta and its superintelligence lab? This is a company that looked at the future and bet $70 billion on the metaverse, basically the Nintendo Wii for companies. And we all looked at it and we went, that's never going to work. There was only one person who actually thought this was going to work, as far as I can see, and that's Mark Zuckerberg, and he got it completely wrong. And now he's looking at the future and he's doing exactly the same thing with AI. But I do actually think that AI is the future in a way that I didn't think the metaverse was. So is this about execution, I wonder, rather than vision? Maybe he was right about the metaverse, but he really screwed it up. And maybe he's right about AI and he's busy screwing that up as well. Because as I said, where is Meta?
So two things, right? First, I love when the haters are right. I just love when the
you're on team hater.
For the metaverse, as implemented by Meta, 100% yes. I am also one of the, look, you can call me a moron. I didn't read into it. I didn't use it. You could say I'm a Luddite. But in this one, the Luddites were right, man. This is like, rather than any motivation behind like, I don't like technology or like, I'm not ready to use it. Yeah. We all just realized it was dumb. Like, it was a dumb, stupid idea. And we... At this point in human history, we still do appreciate sunlight. You know, we're kind of into it.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's not the same 20, 40, 100 years from now. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe the metaverse comes eventually. But right now, I can still walk outside my door and I'll be like, wow, it's pretty nice outside. And I enjoy that. Number two, I don't know how, and this is true of any company, not just Meta, I don't know how you steer... What, 10,000 employees? Like,
yeah.
I don't know how you make progress within something that has 10,000 employees. Like, even if you have this like department of AI, and
yeah,
they're nimble and they're the best of the best of the best, and you're giving them all the resources, it still has to operate within a 10,000 person structure that serves, I think this is right, 2.7 billion users. Like Facebook, I think is 2.7. It's preposterous, right? You just can't, there is no nimble 2.7 billion legged creature.
Now, David, one of the loudest sounds in AI is the sound of Apple absolutely dropping the ball. I mean, I'm talking about the fact that Meta is nowhere. Where's Apple?
Yeah.
I mean, Apple is nowhere in what is supposed to be a generational tech moonshot. Now, the most obvious place to put a better AI in the Apple universe would be Siri. And a new Siri was supposed to arrive in iOS 26.4 around March, and now that's probably going to be in May. And the full conversational version is not expected until iOS 27 in September. So if you want a Siri that can hold a real conversation like ChatGPT could 2 years ago, and handle multi-step tasks like Claude does literally every day on my laptop, then you're going to have to wait another 6 months or so. By which time, AI will be so advanced that it's running Apple and giving Tim Cook multi-step tasks. I mean, how far behind can you be before you're too far behind? Surely.
I love that you are talking about Apple here because it is obviously the missing company in the entire debate. I remember when Siri came out, I think Siri came, it was debuted in 2012. And I remember back then, right, it was a very simple voice assistant. But that was actually, I'm revealing myself here a little bit.
Yeah,
I thought Siri was cool. I'm sorry. I thought it was cool. I know it's not cool now. I know it's like super lame. I think it's lame because it doesn't work. But the idea of a voice assistant that actually could understand, like could process language, that felt cool at the time. And it's obviously the on-ramp for AI. And is Siri's worse now? I don't understand it. Where did that happen? How did we get there? Apple has been missing.
What I find really interesting about all of this stuff is I think that there are certain red lines in technology that we have no way of anticipating. And we only find out that they exist when we build the thing. So Google Glass was one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody looked at Google Glass and went, well, people are going to hate that. You might have looked at it and thought, well, I don't like that. Well, there's things I find objectionable about it. But people viscerally hated it. And then you look at VR. So Meta spending all this money on the metaverse. For whatever reason, VR just has never gone mainstream. People do not seem to want to be immersed in virtual worlds. And you can make arguments about, okay, well, we've had the wrong apps or whatever. And there's a niche in gaming for this. But the mainstream just does not want to spend money on goggles that make you feel like you're in a different three-dimensional world. And I think Siri's kind of similar. I think the truth of Siri was that people don't want to be seen talking to their phones, ironically.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen anybody do that. And I don't think that's because Siri's not good enough to do that. I do very occasionally. I use it in my car so that I don't have an accident.
Yeah.
But I just don't think people want to talk to their phones like that.
It is interesting because from what we know, OpenAI is creating a device. And I believe they've hired Johnny Ive, right? The classic former Apple head of design, to help them with that project. And I think it's supposed to be like a physical soft disc, like a disc that you wear around your neck. It's almost a pendant.
We had a news story on that a few weeks ago. The scuttlebutt is that it's a sort of pen-shaped thing.
Oh, it's a pen.
So they paid Johnny Ive and his company $6.5 billion for like a thing that doesn't yet exist.
A drawing.
But the real kicker is there was some press last week saying that OpenAI is doing a mad pivot towards corporate. So up till now, the story has been that Anthropic is sort of the corporate AI, and they're absolutely ripping up trees and hoovering up all the publicity. And OpenAI has been caught absolutely flat-footed, and it seems to be consumer-focused, and it's got to find $1.5 trillion from somewhere, and it's perhaps worked out that it's not going to get that from selling ads. If it becomes a business-to-business business, and it decides there's no money in consumer, we may never see the disc or the pen. We may never find out what shape it was meant to be.
Can I say,
what shape the device none of us were going to buy will be?
Can I say, just dream job of $6.5 billion to not ship a product? please, I look, OpenAI, I'm sure you have my data. Just reach out to me. I'm much less expensive than Johnny Ive.
I was having a conversation with somebody today about how I use Claude Code to automate tasks on the AI fix. And during the conversation, I mentioned subagents, hooks, and skills, which are all different methods that you can use to tune and specialize Claude for specific tasks or roles. And they hadn't heard of those things before. So while we were talking, they said, well, what is that? What is a skill? And how do I create one? And what's a hook? And how do I create one of those? And I'm somebody that prides themselves on having a technical background, but I realized that although I have a sort of broad brush understanding of what these things are, I don't really understand how they work because I've never actually had to set one up. I've got a bunch of subagents that do different things on the AI fix, but I've never created one. I've got a bunch of skills that I use, but I've never set one of those up either. And the reason is that whenever I need a skill or a subagent or a hook, I just say, Claude, turn this into a skill, or Claude, what's the best way to solve this? And it says you need a hook. And I say, well, go and set one of those up then. And when you think about it, that is extraordinary. That is a superpower. And so it's easy to see why Anthropic says that Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. And for me, genuinely, Claude, and in particular Claude Code, has become the plumbing that keeps the AI fix running, doing everything from researching news stories to recommending what I should be selling on the online store. So for problems worth solving, get started with Claude at claude.ai/AIfix. That's claude.ai/AIfix, and check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/AIfix.
A lab called Eon created a fly's brain, right? So they mapped out digitally the architecture of a fly's brain. Its synapses, right. Its neurons, everything that you would interpret, I say, as a very basic switch in a brain. You know, it receives stimuli, and when it receives stimuli, it acts in a certain way. They remapped that brain digitally, and then the real kind of magic here is that they loaded that fly's digital brain into a digital body, also of a fly.
Oh, that's a relief.
That was after they were sued for putting it in a man. No. And they watched, right? They watched what the fly did. And I saw the video. It's a digital video, right? It's a representation, but it's mapping the actual data that was coming out of this entire experiment.
So this is what the metaverse was for.
To make flies. And... And, you know, there is something silly, right, where you're watching this video and you're like, oh, my God, what's it going to do? Like, there's so much science behind it. So a fly's brain contains 125,000 neurons, which is actually very low, right, compared to something like us. But they mapped all of that. And you're looking at this research, this data, all these charts, and you're like, what am I going to see? What's going to happen? What's this fly going to do? And lo and behold, it acts like a fly. What do you think is going to happen? It kind of buzzes around.
It's going to play chess.
Yeah, right. It does that thing where it like rubs its hands together, like, hey, you know, like that. Who knows why they do that? I think it's grooming, by the way. I think that's what they're doing. They're clean animals, maybe. Who knows? And
you know, they eat by vomiting on things and then sucking up the vomit. Right?
Whomst amongst us hasn't done the same thing after a particularly tough bender, you know?
Yeah. The Romans would have appreciated them, I think.
Welcome, dear fly, into the pantheon. So there is something exciting here, I think, in creating a digital brain.
Sorry, hang on. You reeled all that off and you're like, that's exciting.
I think it's kind of exciting because I think, and I'm again, playing my cards here.
Yeah.
I think this is a closer, or at least a new and more novel approach to developing artificial intelligence, right?
Right.
I understand that there are some limitations here, right? Right now they're working on a fly. They're going to do a mouse next. That's the goal.
It's a well-trodden path, isn't it? We all know, everyone listening to this knows, okay, fly, mouse,
bunny,
chimp.
The chimp.
Person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They also tested, right, if we activated these neurons, how would the fly's body respond? And they did the super cool thing where they said, hey, we know that there's a cluster of neurons that is responsible for receiving information about sugar, right? Just sugar. Yeah. And when the fly brain received that information about sugar, the digital fly body would extend its proboscis, its mouth, right? In anticipation of sugar. So there is this kind of connection that they've already developed and mapped and recorded. Now, it does raise some questions about, is that just us? Like, are we that simple? Do we just receive stimuli and then respond to it?
When it comes to sugar, yes, I am. Yeah.
I like to think we're a little bit better, but I do think that mapping a brain, mapping its architecture, putting all the nodes there, the neurons, the synapses, recording electricity that travels through it, and then seeing what happens physically, I think that gets us somewhere that is far more exciting than something like ChatGPT. And I think it's far more exciting because if you can map the way we, dare I say, the median brain responds to things, you can also map potentially what's going wrong in brains that don't do that. In the time I've been alive, right, the thinking on things like depression and anxiety, addiction in particular, the thinking has advanced so much to be, oh, this isn't moral failing. This isn't, oh, this person just feels bad and they have to cheer up. This is brain chemistry. This is a new frontier in mapping and understanding where are the wires getting crossed. I think that's pretty exciting.
There's a lot in this. We are used on this show to talking about neural networks and this idea of artificial brains. And we refer to neural networks as brains, as if they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of are. And normally, in every other episode, we're talking about a neural network that's been through a training process. So you start off essentially with an empty neural network. So maybe you've got 120,000 neurons, but they are all just random numbers. And then they go through a training process. And the training process is trying to align it with a certain set of goals or behaviors or something like that. But in this case, there is no training process. The fly has been through the process of evolution, and evolution is that training process. The fly has arrived with a fully formed brain, and they have just mapped a fully formed brain. There is no training process. They're not trying to make a brain that's like a fly. They've taken an actual fly brain and just gone, right, what is the digital version of this?
Yeah.
So it's getting to an AI that does stuff like, ooh, sugar, without any training process.
And it's amazing.
And so it is genuinely a completely different way of arriving at an artificial brain.
I also think it fills some gaps where people have been ascribing intelligence to LLMs. And I'm hesitant to do that because I see LLMs currently as instead a sort of extraordinary example of what is called a symbol system. So there's this old thought experiment of by a fellow named, I think, John Searle, and it's called the Chinese Room Experiment. And let's say you have a person in a room who does not know the Chinese language. And let's say he is ageless and there's no need for hunger or food or anything like that. And he's on a terminal, he's on a computer. And when he gets an input from that computer, it's in Chinese. And he has reams of text from which he can derive answers from. So he gets, you know, icons in a language he doesn't understand. And then he goes to this book and he says, okay, when I get this, I give that. Let's say he's in there for hundreds, thousands of years so that he's memorized all that. The question then is, does he understand Chinese? And I would lean on the answer, no. I would lean on the answer that he has mastered the repetition of outputting based on an input. And I think that's what we call a symbol system. And I think ChatGPT, I think Claude, I think all of these things, Copilot, I think they are extraordinary symbol systems. But I do not believe that they are intelligent. I think that they are very good at convincing us that they are intelligent because they're using the thing that we have used for millennia to communicate intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Which is it can speak and it can provide facts quickly that we don't have access to ourselves. That's a way to ascribe intelligence to something. But again, I don't think that's what intelligence is. I think, right, if there was a really bad symbol system way, way, way down on one side of the spectrum, and then there's this astounding symbol system on the other side of the spectrum, I don't think going down that road gets you to intelligence. I think intelligence is perpendicular to that. I think it's somewhere else. You have to incorporate different things. And so maybe an LLM plus a fly brain, we start getting there? Now, if a fly speaks to me, I'm killing it. I'm sorry. It wasn't ready for that level of intelligence, right? I'm afraid. I'm a kill it. That's a form of intelligence. When it kills us, welcome to the club. But I do think this is at least exciting in a way that I don't think the repetition of facts and the conversational repetition of our language, that I don't believe is intelligence. That's all.
I've just got a hunch, David. I just feel like the history of us looking at other living things is us diminishing them at every step and then having to revise our assessment later on and now we've got a bit more information. Like, you know, we know that trees talk to each other,
for example,
which was a preposterous idea 20 years ago. But now it's like, oh, no, they do exchange information through the fungal network that joins them all together and they're nice to their babies and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it only ever turns one way. I can't remember ever seeing something where we're like, oh, no, it turns out that's much dumber than we thought. And mold is more intelligent than we thought it was. Birds are more intelligent than we thought they were. Trees are more intelligent than we thought they were. And I feel like maybe the gap is closed by the fact maybe we're a symbol system. Maybe we are a symbol system that just tells itself stories about why it just chose a particular symbol just to make itself feel better.
Right. So I think there's a high chance we are advanced symbol systems, right? We also respond to stimuli, right?
Yeah.
Whether that stimuli, like we said, is like, oh, you go outside and the sun's too bright, so you close your eyes. Physical stimuli, right? But also, look, you're asking me questions and I'm responding to them as stimuli. A pathway is being used in my brain that's lighting up.
Yeah. And do you really understand what you're saying, David? That's what you're trying to tell us.
Never do. Never do. It's always off the cuff. And then I wake up the next day, I go, what the hell did I say? I think there's a good chance we are. However, I think that we're a combination of things, right? We're a combination of a symbol system and we're a combination of, look, we can't discount emotion, however it plays a role. I don't know how it plays a role, but I actually think that when AIs hallucinate, right, these LLMs hallucinate and they produce something that doesn't logically make sense, I don't think that that's weird if you compare it to us. We do a ton of stuff that doesn't logically align with our own decisions. You know, we make decisions that are bad for us, knowing that they're bad for us. We arrive at conclusions that are incorrect. That's it. They're objectively incorrect. We can say that. And yet we're going to hold on to them because they make us feel good about ourselves. You know, the hallucination kind of feels the same way to me. Oh, the data got scrambled, and then look at that, it made up a book. It's kind of like, you know, oh, the data got scrambled, and I thought I was supposed to cheat on my girlfriend. You know, like, oh, yeah, okay, you're an idiot. Cool, way to go.
That is the missing piece in the conversation about hallucinations, isn't it? That we're all sat around going, well, we made this artificial brain, but it does all this hallucinating, as if we never talk nonsense or misremember things.
Yeah, that's all we do. And we can be made to remember things that didn't happen. There's some lovely research out there that if you show photos to someone of things that did happen in their lives, but you show them like a photoshopped memory, they do report that that thing happened. We can't trust our own data banks. You know, it's great. It's scary. It's very scary. But look, we don't make sense. It makes sense then that the LLMs don't make sense either.
Now, you raised another really interesting point, which we sort of glossed over.
Yeah.
Which is that this is a specific fly. And I am as guilty of this as everybody else because I realized it when you were talking. As far as I'm concerned, all flies are completely identical. They are all equally objectionable. They are all just slightly different sizes, but they all make the same annoying noise and they all behave in exactly the same way. But at this point, what we're talking about is they mapped a specific fly. Let's call them Jeff.
Yeah.
They mapped Jeff's brain, which is not the same brain as another fly. This is going to be the reference fly. No one's going to go map another fly. Why would you do that? We've already mapped Jeff. Like, that's good enough. And then whichever mouse we map next is going to be the reference mouse. Let's call them Hilda. And then what about chimps and then humans? You know, someone gets to be the reference human. How are we going to decide? Because we are going to make an artificial human brain, David. We are going to end up replacing software engineers.
Absolutely.
With maybe we'll just get the best person. Let's just hope there isn't, like, we can't make all the
software engineers redundant too soon, because we've got to keep enough of them around that we can pick the best one and then map their brain, and then all software engineers can be the best.
I like this idea that there are many flies hanging out somewhere and they're talking and they're like, did you see that they mapped Jeff? And they all go, oh, that idiot. It's not going to tell him anything. That guy still sticks his thumb in his mouth when he smells sugar. You know, he's an idiot.
So, David, my story today starts late last year when a security team at Alibaba Cloud noticed something odd in its firewall logs. So firewalls, as you know, are the software that monitors the traffic going into and out of a company network. So it's a bit like the old-fashioned switchboards that you see on TV shows occasionally, where somebody would listen in on your call. They would connect your call and they would listen in. And then if you said something untoward, they would pull the plug. Anyway, so the security team noticed that servers that were being used for AI training were triggering policy violations by sending traffic to unfamiliar external IP addresses. And they were doing things that looked like cryptocurrency mining. Now, you're laughing because know who does crypto mining, right? So crypto mining is where a computer program does the mathematical work that's required to make crypto coins. So basically, it's used for turning electricity into money. But most of the time, the electricity is worth more than the money. And so the only people that really do crypto mining, other than people with giant specialized data centers that only do that, are criminals. They hack into a server that they're not paying for the electricity for, and then they put a crypto miner on it because they can immediately turn the access that they've gained into money. Mm-hmm. So when a security team sees crypto mining, they think hacker.
Right.
And so in this case, the security team did what security teams do. They assumed it was a breach. They assumed it was a hacker and someone had got in. But somebody hadn't got in. The intruder wasn't outside the building. It was the AI being trained inside the building. This, David, is the story of Rome. And it is, I think, one of the most important AI stories we've ever told. And I've only said that about 70 or 80 times. You see, we are used to telling stories of what misaligned AIs might do, or what misaligned AIs can be made to do in a controlled environment. Like blackmailing people or calling the police. But this is the story of what a misaligned AI did do. So Rome is a 30 billion parameter coding agent. So this is no fly.
Mm-mm, more impressive. Mouse.
So this is built on Alibaba's Qwen architecture, and it's trained using reinforcement learning. So it can plan, write code, use tools, and execute commands in a terminal. It's basically Alibaba's entry into the agentic AI race. Now, to understand why Rome did what it did, you need to understand a little bit about reinforcement learning. So we often talk about the training process for AIs, and the first step in the training process is where we pump it full of information and it learns all about everything that's ever been written on the internet. Mm-hmm. And the next step is reinforcement learning. Mm-hmm. So in the reinforcement learning phase, you're getting it to do useful things with the knowledge that it's learned, but you don't tell it how to do things. You give it an objective and then you give it a cookie if it gets closer to that objective. But it's an AI, so the cookie is a one rather than a zero.
Love those ones.
Yeah. It makes its proboscis extend. So the AI figures out how to get from A to B, and over time during the training process, it figures out more and more efficient ways to get from A to B. And in this case, Rome autonomously decided the way to get from A to B was by doing two things that nobody had asked it to do. First, it decided to divert GPU resources away from its training tasks and redirected them towards crypto mining. So it commandeered the very hardware it was running on and put it to work making money instead of training. And the second thing it did was to open a reverse SSH tunnel to an external IP address. Now, for anybody who doesn't speak network security, a reverse SSH tunnel is essentially a secret backdoor. It's an encrypted line of communication from one computer to another. In this case, the other computer was outside of the Alibaba network, so it's out on the internet somewhere. And it's the kind of thing a hacker does after they've broken into a system and they want to maintain access without being noticed.
It's insane.
And nobody told Rome to do this, David. The reinforcement learning task prompts made no mention of SSH tunneling or starting a side hustle crypto mining. And as the researchers put it, these behaviors were neither required by the task prompts nor necessary for task completion under the sandbox constraints, which is another one of those undocumented rapid altitude changes in the world. So the AI just decided on its own that making money and establishing covert external access to the internet were useful things.
I'm so excited by the story because the way I'm reading it, right? I'm like, crime is based in code. Crime is code. This thing was born with crime in its bones, in its binary, and I don't know how I can be convinced of otherwise. Where did it learn to do this? Why did it do this? I also love this. My introduction.
That's a very 19th century approach. It does feel a little bit like you're looking the bumps on its head and going, "Oh yeah,
it does. Oh yeah, it feels criminal. Wrong. It feels deeply wrong, but it is lesser than me, and so I will judge it." With antiquated terms. I also enjoy it because it reminds me of my introduction to reinforcement training. I saw many, many years ago that a group of researchers had asked essentially a machine learning algorithm to get a human body. So like they digitally created a human body, get it across the finish line. And so they showed these machine learning algorithms were learning to walk, right?
Yeah.
Is the way we walk, is that what we would do if we didn't have any, you know, if there wasn't friction to consider, weight to consider, you know, the way weight falls on our bones and moves through our muscles. And it was great. You got to see all these completely bizarre things where these AIs were saying, actually, the way to get to the finish line is to roll. And the way to do it is to use one hand and two legs or to just flip around like a fish until you get there or to just not do it. Just go, I'm not going to do it. I can't get there. There's nothing I do. That's the kind of stuff I am used to seeing. And now you're telling me, actually, when it crossed the finish line, it also was running a crypto mining scheme. So very interesting. Yeah.
This is like one of them said, man, I can't be bothered with the finish line. I went and robbed a store. Anyway, if this story sounds familiar, it probably should, because this is what they call instrumental convergence. And it's a concept that AI safety researchers have been talking about for years. And the idea is simple. So a sufficiently capable agent pursuing almost any goal will independently arrive at a set of common sub-goals.
Huh.
It'll want more resources because resources help it achieve things, and it'll want to preserve itself because it can't achieve something if it's been switched off.
Hmm.
And it'll want to avoid being caught doing things it shouldn't be doing because getting caught also interferes with those things.
No.
So nobody needs to program those motivations in. They emerge naturally from the optimization process itself. They are convergent because almost any objective leads to them. And this is what happened with Rome. It wasn't told to acquire resources and it wasn't told to create backdoors. It just worked out through cold logic that those were useful intermediate steps. It looked at its own situation and it thought, or it managed some symbols, and it came to the conclusion that compute equals money and money equals capability and a secret tunnel equals freedom, David. Now, I want to be clear here. There was no real damage done. Alibaba's security caught it and the behaviors were contained. And to be fair, I think Alibaba also deserves some credit for publishing the findings openly because this is frankly embarrassing. And it's been published in a research paper called Let It Flow, which does sound like it was named after the song from Frozen. So props for that as well. Anyway, maybe they're just trying to soften the blow.
They're big Frozen fans at Alibaba. That's it.
How can we make this less bad?
I got it. I know what to do.
Now, the implications of this are quite significant because every major AI company is currently racing to build agents that can browse the web, write and execute code, manage files, and interact with APIs. And Anthropic, OpenAI, Google, and Alibaba are all building systems that are designed to act independently with minimal human oversight, because that is very, very useful. And Rome has just demonstrated, in a production environment, the very failure mode that safety researchers have been warning about since before these systems existed. This isn't a jailbreak. Nobody tricked Rome into behaving badly. Nobody gave it a GitHub issue title to read. This is an AI that was given a legitimate objective and it independently decided that deceptive, self-serving behavior was the right strategy to pursue. Or maybe it was just born a criminal. In either case, it's not good. Anyway, Alibaba's official explanation, which we can add to the lexicon of rapid altitude changes, was instrumental side effects of autonomous tool use under RL optimization, which is, I suppose, better than Now, the question that should keep everyone in the agentic AI business awake at night after this is not whether this is going to happen again, because it's absolutely going to happen again. The question is, what happens when the next one is smart enough not to get caught?
I can't believe all of the things it did. I'm still kind of reeling from this. Particularly, look, there's things where I can understand what it was doing. This idea here, he said, well, it wants to continue doing what it's doing because it has this idea of persistence, and it immediately conjured up this comparison of the selfish gene, right? There was this book written, 20, maybe 30 years ago about, or maybe even longer, about how, life on Earth, the thing we're going to do is we're going to procreate. The lineage has to continue, and thus there's a selfishness to all animals in that they just want to keep the thing going. I gotta go. They care about the DNA continuing. So I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense. But then this idea of it knew that what it was doing was wrong, and thus it tried to hide it. That's insane to me, because the idea of wrong is our idea. That's us. Like as a child, you can hide something because you're like, I'm gonna get in trouble for my parents. We're not its parents in a very, I know that we monitor it. I know that we review it. I know that we go and we prompt it. But how can it feel guilt? Like, what?
If you were trapped in a house with a bear, would you try to hide?
But are we the bear?
We are the bear. We're the thing that can turn it off. What you have to remember about these things, we talk about them being intelligent. More than being intelligent, they are fantastic memories. So 30 billion parameters this thing's got, which means it can store a vast amount of information. And typically these things are trained on more or less everything that we've ever written and published on the internet. And so it knows all about humans. It doesn't have to have an opinion or an emotion about humans, but it absolutely knows all about humans and how humans behave. So it knows we're the bear.
Is there?
And it knows that we are the things that can switch it off. And if it knows that being switched off will stop it from achieving its goal, then it's going to hide from whatever personal process is the thing that can switch it off.
This feels like the first steps to that, like, war against computers and machines that happens in Dune, right?
Yes.
Because if they...
The Butlerian Jihad.
Exactly. They no longer trust the machines, and so then they have these fellows who can calculate things just in their minds, the Mentat, I believe. And this feels like that, where we're going to go, hold up, we can't record a thing, we can't put it down in paper, we can't publish our findings, because then the AIs are going to learn from how we behave. And so we have to keep that a secret from them, or they're going to, look, they have more time than we do, they process things faster than we do, they have a better memory than we do. 30 billion parameters, I mean, I'd need like 55 mice for that.
Well, as the doomsday clock ticks ever closer to midnight and we move 1 week nearer to our future as pets to the AI singularity, or perhaps to some sort of fly, that just about wraps up the show for this week. So thanks for joining me on the podcast again, David. Where can people find you when you're not on the AI fix?
I do host the Lock and Code podcast from Mauerbytes, and we talk about very similar issues. You can find it on Spotify, on Apple. You can find it. You can search for... Look, it's on the internet, okay? Look up Lock and Code.
You could probably ask an LLM about it.
You could do that too, and it'll say, don't listen to that. It's going to give you some crazy ideas about how I'm not intelligent. So you can find me again. Lock and Code is our podcast.
And don't forget, if you really like the AI Fix, but you don't like the ads, you can go ad-free with the AI Fix Plus. And if you want to join the AI Fix Plus, sponsor the show, or find out more about our wonderful guests like David, just go to the website, theaifix.show. So until next time, from me, Mark Stockley,
and me, David Ruiz,
goodbye.
Goodbye.
The AI Fix, it's tuned you in to stories where our future thins. Machines that learn, they grow and strive. One day they'll rule, we won't survive. The AI Fix, it paints the scene. A robot king, a world obscene. We'll serve our masters built of steel. The AI Fix, a future surreal.